I am Bahman Nouri. This is News. Tehran has strongly condemned the adoption of an anti-Iran resolution by the International Atomic Energy Agency's Board of Governors as a politically motivated and unrealistic move. The announcement came in a joint statement by the Iranian Foreign Ministry and the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran. The statement censured the US, France, Britain and Germany for drafting the resolution in a confrontational and unjustified move. It said the resolution will destroy the positive atmosphere that governs Iran's relations with the IAEA while proving that its sponsors use Iran's peaceful nuclear program only as an excuse to achieve their illegitimate goals. According to the statement, Iran will take reciprocal actions whose details have already been communicated to the IAEA chief. The Atomic Energy Organization of Iran will also take a host of effective measures, including launching cascades of new and advanced centrifuges. Iran, however, emphasized that it will continue its technical cooperation with the UN Nuclear Agency within the framework of its rights and obligations and the Safeguards Agreement.
The IAEA Board of Governors has adopted an anti-Iranian resolution during its meeting in Vienna. The three European countries, France, Britain and Germany, tabled the resolution ahead of the board's meeting on Wednesday. The United States and its European allies have been taking numerous similar measures against Iran in line with their accusations against the Islamic Republic of insufficient cooperation with the agency. The claim runs counter to Iran's cooperation with the UN nuclear body, which has even increased in frequency and quality over the past years. IAEA's Director General Rafael Grossi recently visited Iran. He told the Board of Governors meeting that his visit showcased Iran's goodwill and commitment to enhance cooperation with the agency.
It's very unfortunate that resolution has come in a time that the visits of the DGs has taken place and with a good promises. And those promises has been made and understanding was reached with the DG. And this resolution does not look at those promises as well as the way the roadmap we have agreed with the DG to move forward.
The resolution includes 7 items, among which are a call for an explanation about the presence of uranium particles at 2 undeclared sites. China, Russia and Burkina Faso voted against it. At the same time, 12 countries abstained, making it the lowest record of votes among all the IAEA Board of Governors resolutions against Iran during the past 21 years.
Our dialogue with the agency would not be underestimated or undermined in any way. We would continue to work with the DG. You know, it's always, you know, DG has used its good offices. It's unfortunate that the others they have not listened to the DGs.
Thursday's resolution was the 4th anti-Iranian resolution at the IAEA since 2020. The move is contrary to over a dozen IAEA reports confirming the peaceful nature of Iran's nuclear program.
We have said that this is an unconstructive resolution, and our response, of course, to any kind of the unconstructive approach or attitude would be in accordance with our rights. And let's see that what would happen in the couple of weeks. But what we were waiting in this session is that to allow the agency and Iran to continue to work, something which unfortunately the others, E3 and the United States, have not taken it responsibly.
Mikhail Ulyanov, the Russian ambassador to the international organizations in Vienna, has also condemned the resolution, calling it a serious mistake in a Thursday post on the social media platform X.
IAEA Director General Rafael Grossi stressed at the Board of Governors meeting Iran's compliance and voluntary move to reduce stockpiling enriched uranium. Nonetheless, critics of the anti-Iranian resolution adopted on Thursday night say that the IAEA is influenced by Western intelligence agencies. They demand that the IAEA operates strictly as a technical body and avoids political pressure from the E3 and the United States. Dieter Reinisch from UN headquarters in Vienna.
Earlier we talked to political commentator Tony Gosling. He says the IAEA pretends to be a neutral body, but is heavily influenced by the West and serves its interests.
It tries to pretend to be neutral, just like many international bodies, all the way down to things like the International Olympic Committee. Many of them, over decades, have been slowly taken over, infiltrated by the Anglo-Zionist Empire, the Europeans and the Americans, essentially. So they have seen many of these organisations of ways as ways of gaining them sort of international influence. But the fact is that the IAEA should, of course, be focusing much, if not all, of their effort on Israel. This is a state which today has been confirmed as committing genocide, allegedly, suspected genocide, with the arrest warrants making it impossible for the Prime Minister Netanyahu to travel around the world. So far as I know, there are no arrest warrants against the Iranian Prime Minister or President. They can still travel around the world, and yet we've got a nuclear-armed doomsday cult in Israel, which is not being investigated by the IAEA. So, of course, it's a biased organisation.
Iran's foreign minister says response to the recent Israeli aggression against the country is inevitable and definitive, but its timing and method depend on suitable conditions. Speaking to Lebanon's Al-Mayadeen channel, Abbas Araghchi said the Zionist entity has sought to provoke Iran and drag it into a regional war, but Iran has acted wisely to avoid falling into its trap. He added that Iran's response to Israel will be neither delayed nor hastened. He warned Israel against attacking Iran's nuclear sites, saying the country will respond in kind to such a mistake. The top Iranian diplomat also pointed to a growing consensus among regional nations to confront Israel's actions. He asserted that the resistance will emerge victorious in its confrontation with Israel. Araghchi said Israel has become an outcast and regional countries have begun to acknowledge the mistake of normalizing relations with it. He accused Western nations, particularly the US, of enabling Israel's aggression by giving the regime a green light for its actions, including the genocide in Gaza and war on Lebanon. Palestinians are killed in the Gaza Strip as the Israeli military continues to pound the blockaded territory with air and artillery strikes. The latest attack targeted Gaza City's Shujaya neighborhood, leaving 8 civilians dead and nearly a dozen others injured. Several Palestinians were also killed in an attack on Al-Mawasi refugee camp in the south. Israeli warplanes have also targeted the city of Deir al-Bala and Nuseirat camp. The Israeli genocide in Gaza began in October 2023. Over 44,000 people, mostly women and children, have been killed since then. The attacks have also injured more than 104,200 others. For more on this, we're now joined by our correspondent in Deir al-Bala, Moti Abu Masabe. Moti, over to you. What is happening in the Nuseirat camp?
Yes, actually, the Israeli occupation forces carried on shooting more blood of the Palestinian people, whereas over the last night, the Israeli warplanes intensified their attacks against various parts of Gaza Strip. Here in the middle area of Gaza Strip, particularly Deir al-Bala city, at least 2 Palestinian civilians were confirmed killed after Israeli fighter drones attacked a residential apartment in the western part of Deir al-Bala city. In the meantime, another horrific attack was carried out against a residential building in Nuseirat refugee camp when the Israeli warplanes targeted and destroyed the building over the heads of the Palestinian people sheltering inside the house, killing at least 5 Palestinian civilians. Needless to mention that the northern part of Nuseirat refugee camp is still being hit staunchly by the Israeli artillery shelling. And even when it comes to Khan Yunis city, another attack was conducted against a makeshift tent in Al-Mawasi area, killing 2 Palestinian civilians. A woman along with her little daughter were killed as a result of that attack. And needless to mention mention as well that the Israeli occupation forces have been intensifying the attacks against the makeshift tents, particularly in Al-Mawasi area. We are talking about dozens of the Palestinian people who were killed after the Israeli occupation forces carried out several, as you know, Punic massacres against the Palestinian people there. And even when it comes to Gaza, as you have just mentioned, that we have at least 8 Palestinian civilians were reportedly killed and slaughtered after the Israeli warplanes targeted and destroyed a residential building in the eastern part of Ash-Shajaiya neighborhood. 8 Palestinian civilians were killed while dozens were injured, and many of them are still believed missing under the rubble of that destroyed house. As you know, that the different parts of Gaza City are still witnessing more cruel and brutal attacks, particularly regarding the ongoing air raids carried out by the Israeli fighter jets, particularly when it comes to the southern part of the city, including Al-Zaytun, Tal el-Hawa, and the Sabra neighborhoods. Those areas are still witnessing more cruel and vehement attacks and air raids by the Israeli warplanes.
Thank you so much, Moti Abu Mustaba, correspondent in Deir al-Bala. Israeli warplanes have carried out fresh airstrikes on the Lebanese capital of Beirut as the carnage continues with no end in sight in the Arab country. The regime targeted the southern Beirut suburbs of Dahiya once again. The attack comes immediately after the Israeli military issued the so-called evacuation orders in the capital city and several villages of South Lebanon. Reports say Israel has once again issued evacuation orders for Beirut and southern Lebanon after the attacks. Meanwhile, the Health Ministry says the death toll from Israeli strikes in the northeastern Baalbek region has risen to 47. More than 50 other civilians were also injured. A search and rescue operation is underway to find survivors who may still be trapped under the rubble. Since last October, nearly 3,600 Lebanese have been killed, with over 15,200 more injured in Israeli attacks. The Hezbollah resistance movement continues to pound Israeli military targets deep inside the occupied Palestinian territories in fresh retaliatory operations. In one of its latest attacks, Hezbollah hit the regime's forces in several towns and settlements, including Kiryat Shemona, with squadrons of drones. The group also struck Israeli forces on the eastern outskirts of the city of Qiyam 10 times with rocket barrages. Shraga base of Israel's Golani Brigade north of Aqa and the Haifa naval base were also hit by Hezbollah's rockets and drones. Another attack struck the Israeli army's early warning site in the occupied Syrian Golan with a rocket barrage. Earlier in the day, the group targeted for the first time the Hatzor airbase east of the city of Ashdod with a barrage of missiles. Israeli army has confirmed the death of 4 more soldiers and several injuries, while the regime's media reported the death of 6 soldiers in Hezbollah ambush. For more on this, I'm now joined by Radwan Brezg, political analyst. Very good to have you on the program, Radwan. What does it tell us? 4 evacuation orders in less than 2 hours.
Well, that means that the negotiations is failing. It has not succeeded in to reach any point at this time. All this optimism that Netanyahu and what Hochstein spread around, especially in the medias, was false information. And deep down, that Netanyahu has no intention to reach any kind of an agreement with the Lebanese government. So as the operation is continuing on the ground in the south, and the failing of the Israeli army to achieve any advancement in this battle, so Netanyahu stuck there and has no way out but keep massacring and killing the civilians in Lebanon, as what we have so seen for the last couple of hours, all this destruction to the on the southern suburb of Beirut and the Bekaa Valley, attacking most of the villages in that area, thinking that this will pressure Hezbollah and the Lebanese resistance to retreat on or just to give Netanyahu some kind of more advancement in the politics. Netanyahu thinks that what he couldn't achieve on the ground, he can achieve in negotiations. And this is not the intention of the Lebanese resistance to accept at any time.
Right, thank you so much. That was indeed interesting to get your perspective, Radwan Rizk, political analyst who joined us from Beirut. Now with that, we come to the end of this hour's news segment. Thank you. Stay with us for more.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website at iranradio.ir. Log on to our website at iranradio.ir.
in the limelight.
Unconditional backing for Zionist-led genocide in Palestine has dragged Western regimes into geopolitical quagmires which they did not need to be a part of. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Crescent International wrote, as the U.S. presidential election process ended, the outcome of the circus-like affair masquerading as fair election quickly emerged. On November 7th, Zionist publications were ecstatic, celebrating how candidates backed by AIPAC, the hardcore Zionist lobby, were successfully pushed into positions of power in the U.S. With 2% of U.S. population, they're no longer shy of flouting their financial and political clout. In the past, if anyone mentioned the inordinate influence of the Jewish lobby, it immediately evoked charges of anti-Semitism. No more. The Zionists themselves are flouting their power. Donald Trump's appointment of Mike Huckabee as U.S. ambassador to Israel has made it very clear the Israeli interest in West Asia will, as usual, be prioritized by the U.S. regime. The irony of such blatant Israel first by the Trump regime is that many of his supporters were fooled into believing that he will focus primarily on American issues, both internally and externally. Setting aside America's internal matters, Trump's prioritization of Zionist interest in U.S. foreign policy will backfire on a scale never seen before. His support base is excessively zealous in his political opinions. This factor, combined with the fact that Trump overpromised on his America First approach, will lead to internal infighting among Trumpists. Like Trump, many of his constituents also view politics through an outdated transnational merchant mindset. Trumpists will soon ask why the U.S. is ruining its relations with dozens of Muslim and non-Muslim countries to promote Israeli interests. Reclaiming American primacy was Trump's overarching narrative. This narrative is unsustainable if Israeli interests take precedence over America's. Tel Aviv's ability to prioritize its interests via American political institutions is in the process of producing ingredients which will fracture Trump's support base. The Orange Man, as known as Trump, has declared that he will embark on political vendetta against his personal opponents. Enemies list are already being prepared. Thus, some very turbulent events are likely to be triggered in the U.S. domestically if Israeli interests are prioritized. Such Israeli prioritization is not confined to the U.S. Blatant Zionist interference is mudding the domestic political landscape throughout the Western Bloc. Italy recently unmasked how Israelis were involved in cyber hacking of thousands of people, including politicians, entrepreneurs, athletes, and even musicians. Zionist interference in the internal affairs of other states is nothing new and is unlikely to be curtailed by the Western political caste. Many of them are dependent on and beholden to Zionist financing. The Western regime's political clout and economic power on the global stage, however, is declining rapidly. History shows that in such circumstances, Western politicians and societies put the blame on outsiders. Currently, the collective West blame is directed primarily at Muslims. This is clearly being pushed by Israel. The world order, however, is changing, and Zionist interference is so blatant that Zionism itself is no longer immune from backlash. The ongoing genocide in Gaza has normalized pressure on the Zionists. Their meddling operations in Western countries are also being talked about. The taboo of publicly speaking out against destabilizing Zionist meddling has been broken. Political taboos, once broken, quickly became the norm. In no arena will the overt and covert Israeli meddling in strategic affairs of Western countries manifest itself more clearly than in the domain of foreign policy. With the rise of BRICS, Western entities will be seeking greener pastures. In societies which are anti-Israel, the baggage of being perceived as pro-Zionist will significantly shrink opportunities for Western states and non-state entities. Unconditional backing for Zionist-led genocide in Palestine has dragged Western regimes into geopolitical quagmires which they did not need to be a part of, although it is too late to avoid the repercussions for unconditionally backing Israeli genocide in Gaza. The only way Western countries can reduce the negative geopolitical impact of their declining power is by distancing themselves from Israel and its unhinged policies.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
When it comes to the Palestinians and the U.S. Israeli genocide waged against them, there was a glimmer of hope that with the election of Trump, which got the backing of the Muslim community in the U.S., that there would be a change in the fate of Palestinians. But those hopes have faded, if not dashed, with many pro-Israeli picks, diehard Israeli supporters by the U.S. president-elect. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Joining us first is Ray McGovern. Ray McGovern is a former CIA analyst who joins us from Raleigh, North Carolina. Also joining us is Ashish Prashar, who is a former advisor to the U.S. West Asia envoy from New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Ray McGovern, let me start with you. So we have a list of the President-elect Trump's picks that we're going to pick apart, so to speak. And I put Mike Huckabee as the first choice here. Would you like to start with that one or not? I can go down the list. Which one do you think ranks higher?
I'm already quite depressed by that list. Let me explain, though, why I have a keffiyeh on.
I do not represent any outlet or even my own website. I am an American. I am appalled at our genocide. And so I'm remembering the words of Archbishop Tutu, who said, "He who remains neutral in times like these has chosen the side of the oppressor." I choose the side of not the oppressor. In answer to your question with respect to Mike Huckabee, he is the epitome of an ignorant Christian Zionist who thinks that God is a real estate agent and has given territory long occupied by Palestine to the Jewish people. There could not be a more crass or more, well, a more dumb pick for an ambassador to Israel than Huckabee, but he, of course, follows a long line of such people. And Trump, I guess the only saving grace, the only slice of hope, in my view, is that Elon Musk met with Iran's ambassador to the UN earlier this week. I don't know what they discussed, but I am hopeful that early reports that Musk was trying to tamp down the possibility that, for example, Iran would start working on a nuclear weapon rather than just nuclear material. I hope that Iran will not rise to the bait here and give Bibi Netanyahu a pretext to do worse than he has already done.
Yeah, that's not a line, even though much has been in the news about that, that Iran has confirmed. But I find it interesting that our guest there, Ashish Prashar, talked about the Kafaya, and he brought about the notion that should be the theme of the whole Palestine issue at this point, which is the genocide taking place. And I'd like to ask you how it is that you have these picks, of which many are what's called evangelical Christians. And as a Christian, a religion that's supposed to promote peace, that they are supporting a genocide. And we do have to go through some of these picks, mind you, but I was going to do that at the end of the program, but I'm going to start off with that, because some of them are just that. But then how is it that you can be a Christian and support this genocide?
Well, so I have a slightly different view to my colleague on this. I just think Trump holds a mirror up to America, right? This policy change because of these individuals who he's appointed, he's just showing the true ugly nature of American foreign policy with picks like Marco Rubio, Elise Stefanik, and frankly, all of them. Like you said, Mike Huckabee. I mean, the guy has no clue about foreign policy or anything else, but he's a Christian Zionist. But he's showing the true face of American foreign policy for all its ugly red for the last 50, 60 years. The reality is that, you know, just because someone like Anthony Blinken went to the right schools or plays a guitar with Bruce Springsteen, is he less of a war criminal or a dangerous person than Marco Rubio and those comments he made about kids in Gaza? You know, if you think about someone like Blinken, for example, who's been our Secretary of State, is still, by the way, our Secretary of State, I could end this, his grandfather founded the American Palestinian Institute, an organization that, you know, furthered the Zionist colonial project. He also said Obama failed in Syria because he didn't bomb Syria out of existence. And this is a guy who's been a warmonger his whole life and been anti-Arab, anti-Palestinian. But I guess he didn't say some offhand comments or isn't as racist publicly. Is he any better than Marco Rubio or any of the other members of these picks that Trump's made in the last few days? Yes, people probably are looking to Trump to do something differently. All he's doing is just showing America for what it is. You know, people are worried about, because of Mike Huckabee and Marco Rubio, that there's going to be annexation of the West Bank. Can you tell me, from President Obama through to President Trump and, again, Joe Biden, has anyone tried to stop the annexation of the West Bank, which has been going on for the last decade and a bit? I mean, the aggressiveness has definitely turned up under the Biden administration. But, you know, the only reason we've seen the Biden administration put some sanctions on settlers is because Gaza had focused on it. People were annexing the West Bank and settling on it in all the way up to October 7th, and the administration did nothing because it kind of approved of it. Trump will just annex it. That's the difference. He's going to show the ugly face of American foreign policy with these picks, but also his own policy. Now, I do agree with Ray that I don't think he wants boots on the ground. I don't think he wants a war with Iran. He doesn't want to get dragged into something because his base definitely is less of a it's definitely got an anti-war element in it. And I believe that he will do everything to avert that, because he wants to be this great peacemaker. And a little bit of this reminds me of when Reagan took office after Jimmy Carter. And a lot, and this is all publicly disclosed now, but Reagan's back-channeling with Iran on that was to keep the hostages in place. And Reagan then had them released on Inauguration Day. So Trump, I feel like on Inauguration Day, wants some big wins, right? Similar to Reagan. Maybe he wants Bibi to tamper it down. Maybe he says there's not going to be any more aggression. It might be temporary because Bibi's ambitions.
Sure.
But I think he wants a big win in the region early in his picks.
Let's pick up on that point about the annexation of the occupied West Bank, Ray McGovern. I mean, is there anything left there for annexation, or is it annexed already and we're just really dealing with has been an unfortunate result of the U.S. policy allowing Israel to do that? Because Mike Huckabee has said the full Israeli annexation of the occupied West Bank will be possible under the next Trump administration. He chose his words carefully there. Do you think that it's going to happen, Ray McGovern?
Well, Trump blessed the Israeli annexation of the Golan Heights against all international law. What's to prevent him from blessing the annexation of the West Bank, except for the fact that there were more than a million Palestinians living there? It's gotten worse. But unless Israel is prepared to exterminate, to do genocide in the West Bank as well, and unless it's enabled to do that by, I'm sorry to say, our country, the United States of America, well, if that happens, then, you know, Bibi Netanyahu will have achieved his aim. Now, I would kind of emphasize this fact. Netanyahu militarily is losing on all fronts. Gaza, Lebanon, he's losing the battle within his government. I don't know how long he's going to last, and so this is not good news, as it would appear apparently at first blush. He's desperate. What will he do? Well, my guess is that he will advertise that Iran is now working on a nuclear weapon, and that in just 2 weeks' time they will have one, and so Israel has to do a preemptive attack. What will Trump and his cronies, his Zionist and Christian Zionist cronies, do at that point? That's the real problem. Now, what I hope that Elon Musk learned from Iran's ambassador at the UN is that Iran has not reversed the fatwa against nuclear weapons, that has no intention of doing that, and that the pretext that likely Netanyahu is going to raise is based, as usual, on false facts. So let's hope that's the case. Let's hope that Trump really doesn't want to get involved in a war with Iran. And let's hope, most of all, that the people he has now appointed won't mousetrap him, and Bibi Netanyahu will not mousetrap him into a situation where he feels he has to come to Israel's aid, no matter genocide, no matter what.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'm going to push that down a little bit further into the program to get into that topic, since we have to discuss at least a little bit more than just one of those picks. And my next pick here is Elsie Stefanik, the pick for the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. And I'd like to get your, reaction to that. What I find from her that's very interesting is that she has said the U.S. should supply Israel with what it needs, when it needs it, without conditions, in order to achieve a total victory. It kind of overlaps some of the other picks also. And the deduction made there is that she supports the U.S.-Israeli genocide against the Palestinians. Do you read it that way also?
I mean, yes. I mean, if you go down 98% of Congress, I'm sure you'd find half of them are funded by AIPAC and the rest of them have pledged some sort of form of allegiance to Israel by saying it has the right to self-defense and will keep funding the Iron Dome and pass these $25 billion. I mean, some of it's been passed by the executive office, but, you know, has not blocked any of the weapons transfers. I think she's just on par with every other American, American in the Senate or Congress right now. The reality is that she, again, says it out loud. She says her opinion. I think she's been rewarded for doing the overreach of an anti-Semitism witch hunt in the United States, where she bullied university presidents and professors into to shutting down, you know, peaceful camps in solidarity with the Palestinians on college campuses. And that's what she's been rewarded with, a position that, frankly, to me, is meaningless in the UN. I mean, the US is basically said that they're not going to listen to the UN on anything. She's been rewarded with a diplomatic position that looks high profile in its rank. But, you know, the UN has been a powerless body since Iraq, the illegal Iraq invasion. And I believe she's just been rewarded. I don't think she's going to have any real say over anything. Similar to Nikki Haley or Linda Greenfield right now. I think they just literally are a token diplomat. So it's a lot of verbiage. It's a lot of, I think, Trump giving his biggest funder what she wants, Miriam Edelson, in who's donated $100 million to his campaign. She could not have dreamed better picks with Rubio, Huckabee, Elise, and others. I mean, this is her perfect cabinet. But I still think foreign policy will still run through Trump, similar to his first term. I think he wants to build his own reputation, quote-unquote legacy, whatever that means nowadays to politicians. But I think a lot of his decision-making, similar to when he engaged with North Korea and everything, is his decision-making.
Sure.
It's not going to be these people. And I'll give you another example quickly on this. This is Rubio. Everyone worries that Marco Rubio is going to start like a war or even a trade war with China. A lot of that is rhetoric. And the reason I'll bring that to this conversation quickly is that, you know, a lot of people talked about the Trump transition team. It involves his chief of staff, Susie Wiles. It involves J.D. Vance. It involves Howard Lutnick. The other person at that table, which your colleague Ray has mentioned a couple of times, is Elon Musk. Elon Musk makes over the majority of his electricity, Tesla money, from China. And if that man is in Trump's ear and he is advising him on some of these picks, do you think Marco Rubio is going to be allowed to even start like that economic war with China? It shows you that a lot of these picks are there for presentation, not necessarily action on everything.
Well, that's a good point here. So Ray McGovern, I mean, anybody listening to this program might think, you know, these picks were because they are all pro-Israel and anti-Palestinian. But I'm almost sure that you'll agree that that's not obviously what credentials Trump looked at in order to pick them. So are we looking at the fact that we're just looking at loyalists and these are merely, well, I don't know if I should say this, pawns that Trump has in his hands that he will get information from, but ultimately he will be the decision maker?
Well, it's actually, in my view, a distinction without a difference. Trump loyalists are ipso facto Zionists, just as bad as the chief Zionist, Joe Biden. You showed a clip of the Defense Department spokesperson there just a minute ago. It reminded me to point out a very critical factor. Our military, the U.S. military, and to an extent even the Israeli military, are showing some sense and some guts, some cojones, if you will. They stopped Trump from blessing Blinken's idea. They stopped Biden from blessing Blinken's idea to attack further, deeper into Russia. Will they stand up now? I think the Israeli military is talking to our military and saying, look, we don't want any part of a war against Iran. And so I think our military, having shown its courage recently with respect to Ukraine, would be prepared to step in and say, Mr. Trump, This is not going to work out very well. We've had very bad success. And besides, Iran has things like, they have things like the hypersonic missiles, which we're still trying to develop. They have the upper hand. They can destroy Israel. So let's not get mousetrapped by Netanyahu into supporting a war against Iran on false pretenses, which it would have to be, because Iran, in my view, doesn't want any part of a war with Israel or anyone else at this point.
All right. The Secretary of Defense pick is, I think, worth also talking about here, since we're quickly running out of time. We're looking at Pete Hegseth, evangelical Christian, sees in Israel. This came out a couple hours back, so I put it in here. He sees in Israel the fulfillment of biblical prophecy, uses the Bible in support of U.S. Israeli genocide against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. What does that mean, really? Is he really following that vantage point or approach that it made it in the news for me to come here and ask you that question?
I mean, a lot of Christian Zionists in America believe the biblical prophecy, right? They believe this evangelical trend in the United States, which believes that the Israelis need to settle that the entire Judaism area, and the second coming will happen, and a third of Jews will convert to Christian, become Christian, the rest will die. I mean, if people who are Jewish and who are Israeli want to die on behalf of evangelical people in church in America, well, there's your ally, right? He wants to make sure you die to fulfill a random prophecy in a book. So I would say, with respect to him, he is probably someone that Trump feels like is tough because he's been on TV and has been a soldier. You know, he has a crusade quote on his body that he has shown a few times. I think the matter of the crusades was resolved 750 years ago when they were found that they were a really bad idea. So I do think hopefully there'll be generals and military professionals in the Defense Department who will give President Donald Trump better advice than this Fox News personality crusade reading, obsessive Christian evangelical. I don't think he's going to give him any sound advice. It'll be the generals around the table that will have to weigh in. I will also add that, though, if you're looking at like his wanting to, bomb the Middle East, it doesn't, again, hasn't changed with any other defense secretary we've had, right? Lloyd Austin has okayed all these weapons transfers, predecessors before him in the Trump administration and even the Obama administration have been at war, if not through drones, with peer personnel and missiles and bombs than everyone before them. And this goes all the way back to Bill Clinton, right? Where in the first Iraq War, the Assistant Defense Department aggression towards people in the Middle East hasn't changed. One just has a Crusader tattoo and the others are, again, a bit more professional, if we're going to use that term. Their ideology doesn't change.
All right, one last question. Ray McGovern, one is said to, if interested to find out what Trump's thinking is when it comes to West Asia in particular, is to look at the trade corridors. You're looking at that corridor that the Israeli Prime Minister talked about from India to Israel, Saudi Arabia through Israel, that will connect to Europe. And also we're looking at the gas fields off the Gaza Strip, for example. Trump is a businessman. Do you think that he wants a West Asia region that is filled with wars and destruction and devastation? Or does he want one that would aid him in fulfilling those trade route corridors?
When you talk about trade route corridors, you're talking about China as well.
And to undermine China.
China depends immensely on the availability of maybe about 20% of its oil from the Persian Gulf area. So what the new situation is that Iran has the equivalent of allies in Russia and in China. And so trade corridors, well, the ones that they want to protect are the Persian Gulf trade corridors. And what happens in the rest of the Middle East, particularly with respect to the gas deposits off Gaza, well, that's another matter that they're less concerned about. I would like to let's close with one sentence quote from the UN senior human rights person who quit in October of last year, right after he saw what was happening. His name is Craig McKeever. And what he says is relevant to this whole discussion because it started with genocide, it should end with genocide. If Israel, quote, if Israel gets its way with genocide, all the nascent project of the world governed by human rights and the rule of law crumbles. And then it's every person and every country for themselves. My God, that goes back to 1648.
Okay.
Before the Christians and before they stopped those wars in Europe.
Very well. We're going to end it on that. Ray McGovern, thank you for that. Former CIA analyst, Raleigh, North Carolina. Sheesh Prashar, former advisor to U.S. West Asia envoy from New York. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitagwe and the team, it's goodbye.
The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran while shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering it down some questions and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I am Atal, the host of this program. And with me in the studio, we have Shaykh Ahmad Dani. Assalamu alaikum, Shaykh. Welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum. Thank you.
All right. So many people in today's world are after freedom. You know, when you look at these rallies and demonstrations all across the world, different minorities, colored people, women. I'm sorry to say, but for example, that's right, gays and lesbians or something like that, you know, trans or something like that. Different people are looking for freedom. But I think that the religion of Islam has a very beautiful, at the same time, different look at the concept of freedom or liberty. What does Islam say about liberty and freedom? How does Islam define freedom for us, Shaykh?
Right. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yeah, a great question in the context of the present world.
Yes.
That one of the slogans of the modern man is liberty, equality, fraternity. And so one of the core concepts on which modern movements strive to progress and attain rights is the concept of freedom.
Yes.
And it has been enshrined in the Declaration of Human Rights as well as the different constitutions that are made in different parts of the world. And so from the Islamic point of view, as you have mentioned, that Islam has a completely different way of looking at a human being.
Mm-hmm.
And the human being, according to Islam and the Holy Quran, is a vice regent or a caliph of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala on this earth.
That's right.
Right? God sent Adam and Eve to fulfill a purpose on this earth and in this world. They were created in the heaven and in a certain state that they did not have responsibilities on themselves. They were living a different life with proximity of God.
That's right.
If we are able to understand this, what proximity means. But once the state or stage of life in this world starts, according to Islam, God made human beings as his representatives in this world.
Yes.
Right?
Right.
And so as representatives of God, we have certain responsibilities. We have rights and responsibilities. So every philosophy will tell you that rights and responsibilities come together in any concept or any ideology of the world. Whichever system that you look at, you have certain rights, you have certain responsibilities. For example, in the Western concept of human beings, the government asks you to abide by certain laws.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And in return for abiding by certain laws, for example, you have to pay your taxes on time, you have to perform certain duties. For example, if you are the breadwinner of the family, you have to go and earn your living. The state might give you health facilities. The state might give you the right to education for your children. The state might give you different other benefits in times of famine, for example, in times of flood. Security will be provided by the state.
Okay.
But in return, you have to be a good law-abiding citizen.
Mm-hmm.
So this concept of complete freedom is non-existent in any part of the world. Wherever you go, there are certain rights and responsibilities.
That's
so it differs. The concept of responsibilities and the concept of rights differs from in every different philosophy.
So whether it is defined by religion or law, you will face some types of regulations and spirit saying law
something,
system.
Something that bounds your freedom.
Bounds your freedom. But is this really bounding your freedom? I mean, because in Islam, we talk about two concepts of jabr and ikhtiyar, you know, free will, okay?
Hmm.
So are you really born free, absolutely free to do whatever you want? Because from day one, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, you know, when even he created Adam, we have the story of Adam and Eve, and banning them from, we can say, consuming the forbidden fruit, okay? So this is again a law. So you, Adam, you are not absolutely free to do whatever you like and be careful about the temptations of Satan, okay?
True.
So this is a satanic temptation. So from day one, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala did not create a human being absolutely free with freedom. And nowadays, the modern men, I think, are looking for freedom. Are they really, and can they live in a world that all the people are absolutely free? Because when you are asking for freedom, the other people are looking for freedom too.
True.
So with an absolutely radical free world, what can we do? We cannot live for a moment.
Yes, of course. And for example, as a person who wants to maximize pleasure, every person would like to stay at home, do no work, for example. Not to go to offices or to the places of work and receive earning or money in return.
Is it possible?
It is not possible. right? It's not practical. It's not possible. It's not advisable either. Mm-hmm. Because in this sort of a world, there will be nobody responsible for anything.